right. So we'll start the morning off. Steve Ludke, we'll talk about single particle refinement strategies.
Seem to be losing my mic. So you're going to be seeing a little bit of growing pains this week. I switched to a Mac about 5 days ago and decided to very bravely bring it with me here. And there's a couple of things that don't work 100%, but they're pretty close. I was a little unsure exactly what to talk about here. I was asked to talk about refinement strategies. So pretty much like everyone else, I'm going to more or less ignore the instructions and just talk about the same issues everyone else is talking about, but from another perspective. Well, it's not completely true. If you look at the handout, you'll notice I have a lot of slides. So hopefully we'll move through them at a pretty good clip. So here's the overview of a single particle reconstruction strategy that's used in EMAN. Now, every time I've tried to talk about what other single particle reconstruction packages do in the past, I've gotten yelled and screamed at afterwards. So I'm going to more or less limit my comments to EMAN, although I'll make some generic comments about other software as we go through. So the basic idea is, of course, we start out with some particle images, of course, a lot more than that, but start out with some particle images. We start out with some sort of a guess at what the three-dimensional model looks like, and you'll note I have a particularly bad guess here, but nonetheless. Then we go through a particle classification process, and unlike the stuff that Paul was mostly talking about yesterday, this is a reference-based classification process. So the classes are known. I make projections of this in all possible orientations, and of course it doesn't look very interesting at this point. And then I classify the particles. So I take each of these projections and I figure out which of these particles look more like that than they do like any of the others. So I end up with the classified particles. And of course there's a lot more there as well. Once I've got the particles classified, then I take all the particles and I average them together within each class. So now I have a projection and I have an average which goes along with that projection. Now you can see we get some okay-looking averages despite the fact that the references don't seem to mean very much at this point. So right now, the orientation of these averages is fairly random. Okay, then we build a three-dimensional model, assuming we know all of the orientations. That gives us something like that, and then we just loop through this cycle until it converges. So we make new set of projections, we do a new set of alignments, etc., and we just loop through here until we get our final structure out. Now, there are alternatives to this reconstruction strategy. One alternative is rather than doing this sort of classification... Now, this I don't think is a growing pain. Did someone just knock the power out of the projector? Yeah, maybe you shouldn't use that table.
Are there any questions so far? What's the secret to your maps, Steve?
I have a question already.
Yeah.
So if you start with this Gaussian...
blob, yeah. It's not so much round-off error as the fact that... It's mostly the fact that you have to end up with a self-consistent three-dimensional structure. So I wouldn't call it exactly round-off error, but yeah, it's sort of just random drift, yeah.
I mean, what I'm worried about is when you look at it from the in the XY plane...
Oh, wait, hold on, I need to interrupt. This is automation here for automatically setting up the projector. It will auto-focus and do everything else. This is how we want our microscopes to work.
Is this ledger not right now?
So I'm actually going to be talking about that in the next couple of slides. So that's a good opener. All right. So anyway, so there are a couple of other strategies you can use. You know, one strategy is don't classify the particles and make class averages. Just determine the orientation of the particles and then build 3D models and loop like that. Another strategy is make class averages, but rather than trusting the orientations that we got for the class averages based on which projection they were based on, you could do, say, a reference tree classification, and then you have to determine the orientation of your class average before you can put them into the three-dimensional model. And this would typically be done using maybe a common lines mechanism, or you could use the same sort of projection mechanism that I was using before, but on the class averages rather than on the individual particles. So there are a variety of different ways, and the other method is just toss out this whole process and treat it as a big global minimization problem. So you have a global minimization problem where every pixel in the final volume is a degree of freedom, every orientation parameter of each image is a degree of freedom, so you end up with, n cubed plus the number of particles times 5 degrees of freedom. So you end up with a humongous number of degrees of freedom, and you just treat it as a big minimization problem and try and solve it. And Paul Penchek has been working on some of these methods, but that's another strategy. Typically, right now, this is being applied more for final refinement rather than this sort of initial process of getting a good starting structure. Now, a big problem with all of these methods is the model bias problem. So I wanted to say a little bit about that and at least one approach for avoiding that. Each software package will have some mechanism which will allow you to deal with this issue, and I'll take you through one. So let's just introduce the issue. Now, this slide I actually used at the last workshop a couple of years ago, this series of slides. I think it's a pretty good summary. So rather than using the typical Einstein's face, some people use Rosier's face, I'm using my daughter's face because, well, I like looking at my daughter more than David. No offense. So the idea here is that we're going to start with a whole bunch of noisy particle images, and we're going to align them translationally to that reference, and then we're going to generate averages. And what we have here is an average of 25 particles, 100 particles, 250, etc. So you can see we can build up an image from the noise. Everyone pretty much knows that. That's sort of old hat. Okay. Now, in this case, we started with nothing in the images. Okay, it was just pure noise. So we'll put a little bit of signal in the images. So now we're starting with this with noise added to it. You can vaguely make out that there are some, images present in there, but the contrast is very low. That's about 10% contrast. And you can see once again, of course, we get what we wanted. We get the face out of the noise, and it comes out faster now, right? So you can see that we have a better picture, with the same number of particles. Okay, good. That all seems to make sense so far. Okay, now what happens if we start out with this as our data? So this is the image that's embedded in this noisy data, but we align it to this. Now, this isn't my son. This is actually my daughter when she was like one. So. So you align this to this, and, well, unfortunately, what you get out is this, not this. So that's not real good. That's kind of a problem, right? Now, it's not perfect, right? You've got this sort of shadow back here and stuff, but nonetheless, this is the model bias problem, right? We've got data, and what we get out is not the data, but we get out the alignment reference. Okay, well, how do we get around this problem? So I'm going to start sort of from scratch here again. So I've got my noisy data, and I'm going to align it now to this. And again, I get out what we got out before. Now, instead of just stopping here, what if we did something a little trickier? Instead of just stopping with this, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take this data, and I'm going to align it to these. So I'll align all of these images to this, and then I'll make a new average. And I'll align all of these to the new average, and I'll make another new average. And then I'll do that for each of these cases. For this one, when I'm producing the next one, I'll be aligning to the stronger image. So what happens when we do that? So after we've iterated that four times, you can see that the fake signal begins to sort of fade out. Okay, we're sort of allowing the noise to reintroduce itself into the system over and over again. After 8 iterations, the images are basically gone. All you can see is still see a little hint of it in these later images. Okay, well, what happens in the case where we start with the data, the problem that I had before, we start with this image and we align to this and we end up with this. Now, what if we use that iterative process here? And we'll find that almost immediately we get out the correct answer, not the biased answer. Now, something to note here is that this correct answer, while it's correct, it's a little bit blurrier. And the reason it's blurry, of course, is that we've gone through this iterative process and the images are very noisy. So each time, so what we're ending up with in the case where we do something like this, or something like this, what we're ending up with is a situation where we've just done a single alignment, and what we're aligning to is a very sharp image. In this case, the final thing that we're aligning to is a noisy image still. It's not as noisy. It's not horribly noisy necessarily, but it's still a little bit noisier, and that little bit of residual noise means that things blur out a little bit. So the price you pay for getting the right answer is a little bit less resolution, as it were. Okay. Now let's take a look at 3D. So I'm starting out with 4,096 particles of pure noise, nothing in them. And then I'm going to start out with my favorite structure, GROEL, as an initial model. And then we'll go ahead and refine it through the standard refinement procedure without any of that sort of iterative stuff going on. This is basically just doing a straight refinement where you find the orientation of each particle and you put it into the 3D structure in that known orientation, and then you iterate the process. And you can see, after five iterations, you can still make out all of the helices in GROEL. Okay? There was no data here at all. Okay? So this is obviously a real problem, and this is where the real model bias problem comes to bite us. So what about, and if we do a resolution measure on that refinement, you can see this is actually a 6-angstrom resolution map made out of pure noise. So that's a real problem. Okay, well, what can we do? So one thing we could do is turn on that 2D averaging process that I was talking about. So if we do the sort of the E-man style refinement where we're making class averages, that 2D step gives us an opportunity to do that iterative alignment process on the 2D particles before we make our class average. So if we do that, now we're only doing one iteration. The examples I showed you before, I was doing sort of four iterations, at least four iterations of that iterative refinement. So basically what we're doing is we're going through the overall refinement process I told you before, but when I'm making a class average, I'm taking all the particles in the class average, I'm aligning them to each other, I'm making an average, and then I'm aligning them to the average and making a new average, just that one time. And if we do that, things are a little bit better. You can see we can't really make out the helices anymore, but we still maintain sort of the overall structure. So let's try a little bit more. So instead of just doing one iteration, we'll do six iterations. Okay? Now, the iterations I'm showing you right here, these are the iterations of the overall refinement process. And the six iterations are the number of 2D alignment iterations within each of these iterations. And you can see if we do six iterations, it actually degrades very rapidly. Now, if we low-pass filter this a little bit so we can just see it a little bit better. So here's the initial model. And these are all in the same orientation, by the way. And you can see that it no longer looks anything like our reference after a few iterations. We still have some mass left. We still have some structure there. But at least it doesn't look like the reference anymore. And if we do a resolution now, we still get something out. But that something has decayed all the way down to about 18 angstroms. Now, you'd say, well, that's still not very good. I still have a lot of bias for my reference. The saving grace here is the fact that we don't have pure noise. What we're actually reconstructing with is particles. I mean, there's actually real data in there. As I showed you before, it takes about eight iterations to really, if you start with just pure noise, it takes about eight iterations to make the face vanish. However, in the case where we have some signal in there, even if we start with the wrong with the wrong model, after only four iterations, we get very much the right answer. And in fact, really, after one iteration, you've already gotten fairly close to this. So if you're starting with pure noise, right? So if you're really trying to refine from data where there's nothing there, it's still easy to end up with some bias giving you some answer that you don't like. Now, if, in this case, for example, we'd continued refining, another thing that you'd notice is that this isn't converging to a consistent model. It would keep changing with time. So that's a pretty good clue that something's not going right.
So if you go back to the picture, why is the picture offset?
That's because the first alignment that I did was to an image like this, and you can see that this sort of shadow was left behind, but the shadow is offset. In other words, the best orientation to make this look like this was offset a little bit. And then in the next step, I'm aligning to this, so that offset continues. Now, in the actual single particle reconstruction version of the procedure, it recenters after each alignment step. But so the saving grace here is if you actually have data in there, the data will rapidly dominate in this process, and it'll wipe out any of that model bias that you might run into. If you don't have any data in there, then you're still going to get something out, even if you started with nothing. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, what signal to noise does the signal pull out the right answer?
I don't think there's one answer to that question. The basic idea is that the noise will go as the square root of the number of particles, will add, you know, produce a false model as the square root of the number of particles you put in. And if you have some signal present, that will scale linearly with the number of particles. So if you have 100 particles, you'll end up with 100 times as strong a signal in the end if you had signal. But if it's pure noise, you'll only end up with about 10 times the signal. So it scales non-linearly with the number of particle images you have. So as long as you have enough contrast to get the alignment right, at least some fraction of the time, then it's just a question of how much data you've got, basically. Yeah?
I was wondering, could you actually use this procedure you showed us for real reconstructions to run a control so that you can show that the procedure that you used resulted in no model bias? You started with noise?
Which control do you want us to do?
So in other words, I mean, you're talking about the issue that model bias, you know, gives you not the result that you want.
Right.
But it gives you, what you started with.
Right.
So could you use something like your procedure to give you sort of a control experiment where you can show that under the conditions where you do your
Oh, in other words, do a refinement with noise with the same starting model.
Right.
Certainly you could do that, but I think there are more subtle ways to verify that you're getting rid of bias.
Okay.
I mean, for example, you could put an extra lump in your starting model and make sure the lump goes away as you refine or something like that, right? So this is sort of my final conclusions. This is how we deal with that issue in reality. So if you're using EMAN, then you can turn on that iterative refinement procedure. If you want to do this in other packages, you'll have to talk to the other packages with how they deal with this issue. So the general wisdom in the field over past years was that your starting model is very important. And I would say that the conclusion we've come to over the last 3 or 4 years is that, yes, the starting model is very important, but you don't want to have a good starting model. You want to have the worst possible starting model, not the best possible starting model. So the way we do refinements now, particularly in cases where you have like an asymmetric structure or something like that where you don't know what it is you start out with a bunch of different random starting models and refine independently for each of the different starting models and make sure that they converge to the same thing. If they don't converge to the same thing, then you have to run even more starting models and make sure that you can figure out which one is the right one. And there's all sorts of clues you can get to tell you which model answer is right and which answer is wrong. You have to look at better self-consistency between the projections and the class averages. You can look at what resolution, quote-unquote, the refinement runs to. So, for example, if I start with 5 different starting models, and say all 5 of them refine to a different answer. That's very unusual. I don't think I've ever seen that happen. But if all 5 of them came to a different answer, what you would generally see is that one of them would refine to a better resolution than the other ones, and one of them would have better agreement between the class averages and the projections in the final model. Typically, there are maybe 2 or 3, quote, bad structures that you can get out. So if you start out with a very unlucky choice of starting model, it'll converge to something. And there may be a couple of different starting models that will converge to one point, and then then the rest of the starting models will all converge to another point. So there's usually very few false minima in the space. Yeah?
Steve, on the question of should your starting model be as close to the correct result as possible, that might depend upon how much symmetry your particle has. Is my guess correct? Or?
I would say that in the case of highly symmetric particles, there are far fewer local minima in the energy space. So that's kind of true. Nonetheless, I still, well, I'll show a little bit more and sort of explain the reasoning in a second here. So this is just the example of refining from the Gaussian ellipsoid and showing that after just a few cycles, you can get back to the proper structure of Grohe-El. So in the case of Grohe-El, for example, there's only one false minima that I'm aware of, and that's the case where the side views of Grohe-El are rotated 90 degrees from the correct orientation, and you can still get out something that's sort of somewhat self-consistent. But the class averages and projections don't agree at all in that case, and it's a big mess. But nonetheless, there are some cases. If I use a different shape ellipsoid, sometimes I can get it to converge to that other model. But nothing else I've seen. I mean, I can start with random blobs in space, and otherwise it converges always to one of those two things. So I'll just try and explain the reasoning with this very bad figure. So when I said that, you know, you could treat this as sort of a global minimization problem with a humongous number of dimensions, well, I'm representing that problem now as two dimensions. So this is supposed to be sort of a mock energy surface. And this big well in the middle sort of represents the true local minima, the correct structure that you're trying to refine to. So the idea is you're starting out with some initial guess of a structure, and then you're trying to work your way down here. Now, if you're using global minimization strategy, it'll actually sort of try and go downhill towards the middle. Using the sort of refinement strategies we use, it's really more of sort of a random walk around, but which eventually seems to end up at the right place. But proving mathematically that it would is difficult. Now, the problem is that typically the way people will make starting models is to do something like use, say, a common lines-based method. So you make a bunch of class averages and use common lines to determine the relative orientations of the particles. The problem with that procedure is that common lines will give you the right answer will very likely be among the possible solutions. But in almost every case, there will also be a number of almost equally good incorrect answers. And those answers are almost valid, meaning the fact that they have fairly good properties in the common lines space implies that the projections and class averages are actually in fairly good agreement with each other, even if the actual answer is wrong. So what's happening is the energy space is actually very complicated, and there may be some of these local minimum. So if you start out with the answer that you get out of, say, a common lines procedure, and it happens to be the wrong answer, you're basically putting yourself right in the middle of one of these local minima, and you may never be able to get out of it. So it's very risky. So the idea that we're using now is that if you look at this humongous number of dimensional energy space, and there's only a few local minima that you have to sort of avoid, and you start out with just a completely randomized model, the chances of running into one of these local minima on the way down to the global minima is actually fairly small. Right? So starting with a really bad answer is the better approach, because it's more likely to get you to the global minima, because the energy space doesn't have too many incorrect minima. So anyway, that's the sort of the advice that we give right now. Now you say, well, it's really computationally expensive to run 10 different refinements with different starting models. Well, you don't have to run your refinements at full resolution. That was actually on that slide as well. You shrink the data first, right? All you're trying to do is get a rough idea of what the quaternary structure is. So if you've got your 512 cubed map that you're trying to regenerate, shrink the data down to the smallest point you reasonably can where you still expect to see some features in your map, and run your refinement on that. And then you can run your refinements in an hour on your desktop PC. Right? The scaling of single particle reconstruction is such that small problems are absolutely trivial on modern computers. It's only when you get up to really, really large problems that you need supercomputers. Yeah, Joachim. I just say that based on experience. I mean, I've done refine.
But you cannot possibly spend your life finding all these.
I'm saying that this methodology has worked on every particle that I've tried it on so far, including, say, ribosome. So the typical starting models I use are a Gaussian ellipsoid that's sort of elongated, a Gaussian ellipsoid that's sort of flattened, and then two or three just random blobs in space.
And from that
and from that concept, having done it on a bunch of different structures, I would conclude that I haven't run into many cases where there are any bad answers that come out of that system. Sometimes a bad answer does come out, but I'm saying it's fairly rare. Go ahead.
Do you have to have, I noticed your Gaussian ellipse doesn't have handles. Is that a requirement?
No, I mean, because unless you've done some sort of a tilt experiment, the handedness is arbitrary anyway.
Right.
So, yeah. No, that's a good point. Handedness determination is a completely separate problem.
Right, I know handedness determination is, but is it a requirement to have handedness within your starting model?
No. It comes out randomly. I mean, when you're starting with something that's that bad, the first few models you get out are just more or less random anyway. Nico?
When you say that things converge to the same structure,
what
do you call the same?
So that's a good question. And that would be... So what I'm talking about here is sort of the global convergence process, and what you're talking about now is the local convergence process and whether you can trust the resolution that you're getting out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's where you're going with this, right?
Well, yeah.
So, I agree that's still kind of an issue, right? So if you want to, you know, like I pointed out in the 2D images, if you use a lot of iterations of this model bias reducing thing, your final result is blurrier than it could be. So typically what you do is you use this process with a lot of iterations at the beginning, and then you sort of taper them down as you're refining your structure. And then at the end, I don't usually set it all the way down to zero, because that really does still introduce noise bias, but I usually drop it down to, say, one iteration. And that usually gives me a nice trade-off between noise bias that may exaggerate my resolution and blurring of the structure. So, I think there still remains for someone to come up with a good mechanism for defining how much of your final structure is noise bias based versus real.
So, if you start from a purely ground floor, how long it takes to converge to the right structure? In other words, in other case,
how many iterations does it take?
Yeah.
Or how much time on the computer?
It depends.
That would be my answer. It depends. I would say that in most cases, even if I start with a random blob, Goriel will usually converge after about 5 or 6 cycles of the overall refinement loop. Other structures which are more problematical, asymmetric structure that's almost ball-shaped or something like that, will take a lot longer. But I think if you get to the point where you're at, you know, sort of 15 or 20 iterations of the overall loop and you haven't managed to come to any good answer yet, you probably should abandon that attempt and start again. I mean, it is possible to come up with cases where reaching that convergence from a particular starting model, it just never really gets there. There's no guarantees that this iterative refinement process will converge. All right, let me move on to the next topic. So, measures of similarity. So, when we're doing our single particle reconstructions, we have to be able to determine the orientation of the particles, right? So the first question you'd ask is, well, does this particle look more like this or more like this? And that's a pretty easy question to answer. No matter what criteria you use, that's going to come out right. The question's a little bit more tricky when you're trying to answer this question. Does this particle look more like this or more like this, right? And I'll show you just quickly. So that's the variation between those two. Right, you see here? All right. So the criteria that we use to measure the similarity of the particles to the references is pretty important. There's lots of things that people use for this. You can just use a simple correlation coefficient. You can use Nico's modified correlation coefficient, which I confess I don't understand. I mean, not because I tried, I just haven't tried. There's variance, which is equivalent to the correlation coefficient unless you do something tricky. There's phase residuals. There's using various Fourier shell correlation methods. There's mathematically complicated methods like mutual information. You can make a growing list of these various criteria that you could use. Now, well, that's what I'm saying. I said something based on the Fourier shell, so you can integrate it, or you can find the point at which it passes the threshold. I mean, there's lots of things that you could do with that. This was a very generic statement. So, I'm going to present one solution to the problem, which is the solution that we've adopted in EMAN. But you know, this is certainly not the only solution. This just will help illustrate what issues are involved in doing this. So we're going to start with a variance-based solution here. So we've got our reference. Now, I don't have any noise in any of this either, because the noise just complicates the issue even more. So I've got some reference particle, and I've got my particle which I'm trying to classify, and I'm going to use the variance as a classifier. Now, if the densities aren't scaled properly, then of course I get something out that looks like the particle, even if I've got the right orientation, right? So the first thing I have to do is I have to normalize this image to this image. And typically, that's not just a multiplicative process. Usually, you do a linear transformation of the density to optimally match this. So you can plot every pixel value in this versus every pixel value in this, and do a linear regression on it, and then that'll give you sort of the optimal fitting. And if we do that in this case, we get something like this. Huh. Well, we still have something left. What's going on here? Well, this is a little tricky. It turns out that in this particular situation, we misestimated the defocus by a very tiny amount. Okay, so when we're comparing our particles to our projections, we can't just use the projections of the CTAF corrected reconstruction. We have to, you know, decorrect the projections. We have to make the projections look like the particles. The alternative would be to try to make the particles look like the projections, but since that's a CTF correction process and there are zeros in the CTF, that would cause all sorts of problems. So it's better to sort of filter the projections to make them look more like the particles. Now, to do that, we have to know what all of the CTF parameters of the particle are. If we're a little bit inaccurate in that, well, then this is the sort of thing that we get. We get some residual spikiness here. So how do we deal with that issue? Well, we can deal with that issue by optimally filtering the particle to match the projection, or the projection to match the particle. So we can sort of make them match in Fourier space. Now, the reason we need to do that is also because our reconstruction is generally better than our particle. So what I'm saying, hang on a sec, I think I may have gotten one slide off here. Ah, yeah, okay, so all right, so this is the optimization process. So I've gone one step further, and I've now sort of optimized things in Fourier space. And you can see we've gotten a little bit better here as well. Now, the real issue that remains is that, in reality, your reconstruction is generally going to be higher resolution than your class average, or your particle image, if you're doing it on a single particle image. You know, because, of course, the 3D reconstruction is using information from all of the different class averages to build a 3D model. It incorporates a lot more information. So this structure is obviously going to be better than the structure here. So what that means, in a sense, is that this structure is going to be blurrier than the structure that you've already fully CTF corrected here. So to compensate for that, you have to try and make the power spectrum of this really match the power spectrum of this. And when we do that, we finally get to the point where we sort of get this. But even that isn't perfectly optimal. There's still going to be some residual noisiness going on here. And this, of course, it ignores the whole issue of what happens when you put noise in the particles, but we'll set that aside. So this sort of gives the reasoning behind the current criteria that's used for similarity in EMAN. I've seen some people incorrectly characterize it as a correlation-based approach. It's definitely not just a correlation. The idea is, first, you Wiener filter the particle, because a Wiener filter answers the question, how do I make my noisy particle look as much as possible like what the non-noisy particle is, given my knowledge of the signal-to-noise ratio. So you Wiener filter the particle to get rid of the noise sort of optimally. Then you filter the reference particle to match the radial power spectrum of this. Then you normalize the density back in real space again of the reference to the particle, and then you compute the variance between the two, incorporating information about the mask of the particle. And this rather complicated scheme produces better results than the other criteria that we've tried. So if we don't use this scheme, if we use something simpler, like, for example, using a mean phase error as a similarity criteria, the resolution that we get in the final reconstruction isn't quite as good. And if you look at the classification error in the particles, the distribution of classifications is a little bit broader. So this helps sort of sharpen the classifications down and gives us better answers. So there are other answers to that question as well. Nico has one. I don't honestly know what they use in magic, but I'm sure they have some answer to that problem as well. Okay, so now I'm going to move into sort of the body of the talk here. Since anyone who has a four-angstrom resolution reconstruction is required to talk about it whenever they get a chance, I'm going to go ahead and go through the Groyel reconstruction that I've been presenting for a little while now. So this data was first collected in early 2005. And we first presented this four-angstrom resolution reconstruction about 2 years ago. We have finally submitted it for publication now. I'll show you the structure again here in a second. And over that two-year period, this sort of relates back to Bridget's slide the other day. How long does it take to sort of analyze the structure before you publish? Well, a long time. It's not just that we were lazy and sitting around for 2 years and stuff like that. The story that we've been telling has sort of been continuously evolving over that two-year period of time. So the reconstruction I'm going to show you is of native, unliganded Groyel, ostensibly in the absence of ATP and ADP, although that actually pops out as part of the story. The data was collected on Yoshi-style liquid helium microscope at liquid helium temperatures. The data came from 6 microscopy sessions, and they were collected on film. There were a lot more microscopy sessions than this, but these 6 were the only ones that produced consistently good data. The total number of micrographs was 825. They were scanned on a Nikon super cool scan 9000 scanner, so we got about 1.06 angstroms per pixel. We only ended up using about 135 micrographs out of the 825 out of the about 10,000 that were collected, and it gave us a total of about 20,000 particles. Almost all of these particles actually went into the final reconstruction because things had already been pared down at earlier points in the process. I think about 18 or 19,000 went into the reconstruction. And the defocus range was about 1.2 to 2.2 microns. Now, one of the reasons why a lot of the micrographs got thrown out is because they were taken farther from focus than this. And given the 1.06 angstroms per pixel, the problem is if you get any farther from focus than about 2.2 microns, the CTF oscillations get so close together at high spatial frequencies that you can't do the corrections anymore. It's a sampling problem because the box size is small. Virus particles, you don't run into this problem as quickly because the box size is much larger and you have much finer sampling. So if we wanted to do CTF correction accurately for anything beyond 2.2 microns, we would have had to do some funny oversampling on the data, and that would have caused all sorts of other problems. So basically, we just threw out anything that was too far from focus. So here's an example micrograph. You can see the Groyel particles floating around there in ice. The contrast is relatively low. These were taken at relatively low dose because, you know, we were worried about radiation damage trying for high resolution. And this is relatively close to focus. I think this one's about 1.8 microns, 1.7 microns, something like that. Okay, now this is the point where having adopted a Mac is biting me a little bit. I can play my animations, but I can't play them in presentation mode, so I'm going to play them this way. So here's the reconstruction. And this is basically the same reconstruction I was showing 2 years ago. Let's see. Okay. Now, so point I want to make about this reconstruction is some people look at this and they say, well, it looks very nice. You know, I mean, you can see all the little alpha helices in here. And I can see a little structure in the alpha helices and stuff. It's a very nice structure. Okay. But I don't know if I believe it's 4 angstroms. It doesn't seem sharp enough. I don't see side chain densities and stuff like that very clearly. So another point to make. So here's one structure portion of that structure zoomed in. Take a look at this helix right here, this short helix in the middle. And what I'm going to do now is change the filtration used. So I've jibbed up the high frequencies a little bit more. And now you can see that it actually looks a lot more like a helix. And you can see this in a lot of other helices in the structure. This one's just particularly pretty. So you can really clearly see the pitch now, and you can see more densities like side chains sort of sticking out. Now you say, well, why don't I present that structure when I'm showing this reconstruction? Well, here's another part of the structure, which has that filtration which I just imposed. And you can see it looks kind of messy, right? I mean, there's a lot of nice density in there. There's some nice features in some of the helices and stuff, but it's hard to visually interpret. If I filter it a little bit more, then it looks like that. So it's a lot easier to sort of trace the path of the backbone through the particle when you filter the data a little bit more. But if you're really trying to interpret the data in detail, of course, you'd use the slightly less filtered version of the structure. So this is still the structure that I'm going to show in the slides from this point on. Now, resolution measure. So the black curve is the traditional split the data into even and odd halves and measure the Fourier Shell correlation between them. The blue curve is a novel test that I made that I put together when I couldn't get Nico's correlation and Fourier space thing to work on this structure. So this other curve is based on taking the reconstruction, the unmasked reconstruction, masking out the particle, computing the power spectrum of the particle, and then computing the power spectrum of the background outside the particle in the reconstruction, and then computing signal divided by noise. Right, so it's signal-to-noise ratio, converting it to Fourier Shell correlation, and it turns out it comes out to be exactly the same thing. So this isn't based on splitting the data into even and odd halves. This is based on just the residual noise that's present in the reconstruction outside the particle. And you can see that they agree so well that I thought I had cheated in some fashion, but I double-checked. I hadn't cheated in any way. I tried the same method on a couple of other reconstructions, and the results aren't quite as pretty, but they're not bad. Okay, so here's the reconstruction now colored so you can see all 14 monomers in it. We'll just sort of pull out one monomer so we can look at it in more detail. Okay, so there's one monomer. Oops. We'll rotate it around back. We can see this is a two-stranded beta sheet. We can make out the spacing, the space in between the beta sheet. Most of the larger beta sheets in GRO-EL are all in the apical domain, which is the domain up in the top of GRO-EL, and the B factors up there are much higher than they are in the bottom of the structure. So while we see the sheets as these nice curved surfaces, you can't make out the strand separation in that part of the structure. You can get a little bit of a hint sometimes, but you can't really make it out. If we rotate around back this way, so you can see here's another sheet here which actually separates if you raise the threshold a little bit. Nice alpha helices, nice connectivity. So as I say, the B factor is a little bit higher up here. Okay, so now the question is, we've got this great reconstruction, and like I say, we've had this reconstruction for a while. How much can we get out of it? What can we do analysis-wise? So how much can we get at 4 angstroms? Okay. So we've been developing tools for doing backbone tracing on these sort of intermediate resolution structures recently. Now you say, well, the crystallography community should have great tools for doing that, right? Because they produced all of these structures 20, 30 years ago. They should have developed these methods, right? Well, the problem is when the crystallography community was at these sort of intermediate resolutions commonly, the computers weren't nearly as advanced as they are now. So we can apply much more complicated algorithms now than we could apply back then. And most of the time nowadays, the typical crystallographer doesn't even try to do backbone traces if they have, say, a 5-angstrom resolution structure. They work on improving the quality of their crystal. There are people in the crystallography community now that are working on tools like this as well, but I'd say that they're sort of running in parallel with the cryo-EM community in this respect. So the first thing that we're going to do to the structure is we're going to use this novel skeletonization algorithm, which was developed in collaboration between Matt Baker in our lab and Tao Zhu, who's at Wustel. So the skeletonization, typical skeletonization algorithms will take a volumetric density and produce a set of lines. Okay? The novel thing about this algorithm is it also preserves sheets. So you can see where that beta sheet was, we actually preserved a flat thing, and up here where there's some nice curved beta sheets, they also came out as flat planes. So rather than trying to turn those flat sheets into lines, which would then confuse the connectivity interpretation, it leaves them in the structure as sheets. So we can see our lines merging with the sheets. And that's very important in dealing with sort of the overall topology of the particle. So you can see if we look at this structure, I'll spin this around so you can see it a little bit better. So you can see we almost unambiguously resolve the connectivity of the structure. There are a few places where there are, for example, four paths that meet at a particular point. So there are a few ambiguities left in the connectivity of the structure, but there's really only a few. Okay, so what other tools could we bring to bear on this to sort of resolve these ambiguities? Say we're starting from scratch. We don't know anything about where the C-terminus or the N-terminus is in this structure. Very difficult problem to try and place it in a map, particularly when you have these ambiguities. So what we decided to do is start with sequence-based secondary structure prediction, which has become much, much more accurate over the last 5 or 6 years. So we do sequence-based secondary structure prediction, and what that gives us is a map of where, helices are in the structure and sort of the maximum distance between pairs of helices. So I know I have a helix about this long, and it's separated by about by this maximum distance, and then there's another helix separated by this distance, then another helix, etc. So I have this sort of chain. Now all I have to do is I have to map this chain of helices to my three-dimensional structure. Now, so what we do, we put it all together, right? We've got the SSE Hunter results, which I left out the SSE Hunter slide. Sorry about that. So there was another step to the process where we actually identify where the helices are in the structure based on the shape of the density. And there should have been a slide in there that showed that. So we know where the helices are. Then we have our skeletonization, which gives us the connectivity, the putative connectivity of the structure. Then we have our secondary or sequence-based secondary structure prediction, which gives us this. And if we try and then build a model based on that information, there's still a lot of permutations. But it turns out if you write an intelligent sort of tree pruning algorithm, it's possible to actually do that mapping. And you can almost unambiguously assign every helix to its corresponding helix in the structure. When I say almost unambiguously, and the final result, there were two possible solutions. And when you manually went in and took beta sheets into account, because this algorithm only considered the alpha helices, when you manually go in and take the beta sheets into account, one of the answers is obviously wrong. So rather than relying on saying, oh, well, you knew what the structure, you knew where the C and the N-terminus and Gros-Yell were because there's a crystal structure out there, we actually have an algorithm that can come up with the correct answer without any sort of human bias or anything like that. So once you've got the helices in the structure, then you've got these sort of densities trailing off in space, and all you have to do then is sort of follow the path manually and build this into a structure. And we have the beginnings of tools that will actually automatically do this part of the process too, or at least almost automatically do this part of the process as well. So in the very end, in the end, we end up with a complete chain trace, well, C alpha trace of Gros-Yell. Now, without good sign chain densities all over the structure, it's very difficult to come up with a perfectly accurate, you know, a complete chain trace. We can at least come up with the C alpha trace of the structure. Regarding side chains, we actually went through and did sort of a survey, and we looked for all of the large side chains in the structure, and we could accurately identify, you know, find about 50% of the side chains, of the large side chains. One of the issues is that Gros-Yell is very unusual. It has very, very few aromatic amino acids in it. It's kind of known to be an outlier for that. I think it has a total of about 12 aromatics in the entire structure, 500 residues. Okay. So the next thing we do is we compare our C-alpha trace to the crystal structure. And when we do that, we get this red curve. So this curve is showing the C-alpha to C-alpha distance on a residue-by-residue basis, and then we average it into an RMSD down here. So what we see is that for the most part, it's fairly flat, but there are these little plateaus. And what's going on in these little plateaus is those are basically alpha helices, and those are alpha helices where we didn't have, say, a good side chain density to anchor the position, and the sequence-based secondary structure prediction was off by, say, one residue in predicting where the helix would start or end. Okay? So in other words, the helix got shifted by one or two amino acids in its position. So that's what we see in the yellow curve, is instead of measuring a one-to-one relationship between the C-alphas, we actually measure the distance from the C-alpha to the nearest C-alpha in our model. Okay, so one C-alpha may be compared to two residues or in some fashion in that, but it compares sort of the quality of the topology. And you see when we do that, the curve flattens out and we get rid of these peaks. But if you have a structure where you can actually resolve a little bit more side chain density, most of these plateaus would probably go away. And even with that, we have an RMSD with the crystal structure of about 4.4 angstroms. So the topology of the reconstruction is completely accurate. Okay, what else can we get out of this reconstruction? So here's a nice side view of the structure. And what we can see here is that there's not much connectivity between one ring and the other ring. If we look, we can just see this one density. If we lower the threshold a little bit more, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I should point out that this is not the reconstruction I was showing you before. This is the C7 reconstruction of Gros-Yell. So when we had a 6-angstrom resolution reconstruction, we tried dropping the twofold symmetry, allowing the two rings to be different, and reconstructing that. And of course, we got symmetry breaking because just based on noise bias, you'll always get symmetry breaking if you relax the symmetry in the structure. We got a little bit of variation. Then we tried it again, and we got a little bit of variation, but it was different. And then we tried again, and we got a little bit of variation, and it was different. So we couldn't find any self-consistent symmetry breaking at 6 angstrom resolution. At the 4 angstrom resolution structure, we were a little bit worried. I mean, we said, oh, well, it probably won't work, but we tried it anyway. And this time when we did it, we actually got consistent results. We tried starting with different starting models and refining it, and it kept converging back to the same answer within the limits of the resolution that we've got. So we actually observe self-consistent symmetry breaking in this structure. And this structure, the C7 symmetrized structure, is only slightly worse resolution due to the nonlinearity with the number of particles in single particle reconstruction. The resolution of this is about, so the other reconstruction is about 4.2 angstroms, and this is about 4.6 angstrom resolution. So almost the same resolution. So what that means is we can do a chain trace. We can take our chain trace and build it into the top ring and build it into the bottom ring and see how the two rings differ. So here's the D7 symmetrized reconstruction. Here's one ring of the C7. I'll switch back and forth there so you can sort of see. And then here's the other ring of the C7. So I'll just sort of switch back and forth here a little bit. And you'll notice there's sort of subtle variations. Okay? There are, of course, variations in the apical domain because the B factors are high up there, and you can't really trust that very much. But down here in the equatorial domain, which is generally very stable, that you can trust. And as I say, it's very self-consistent. And it turns out that the area that all of these variations are focused on is right back here, which is exactly where the nucleotide binding pocket is for GROEL. So you say, well, that's kind of interesting. Let's take a look in the nucleotide binding pocket. So if we look in the nucleotide binding pocket one ring, we see this. And this is just showing you where the nucleotide should be sitting, right? It's not modeled in or anything like that. We see this, basically empty space. If we look in the other pocket, we actually see a strong density there. And this doesn't really do it justice. The density there is something like 10 times stronger than the density in the other ring. Okay? So there's a very strong density in the nucleotide binding pocket. Now, I told you before that we didn't have any ATP or ADP in this reconstruction, in this data set. And that's true. It was purified, and it was exposed to ATP at the very beginning of the purification process. But then all the remaining processes, all the elutions through the columns, spinning it down, everything, there was no ATP left in the system anymore. So what this means is this residual, it's presumably ADP, since GROEL will act as an ATPase even in the absence of GROES and substrate. So presumably it's ADP by this time. But it seems like the ADP is sticking very strongly in one ring. Okay, so we observed nucleotide. Let's see. What else do we observe? So, yeah, right. So now this is where I was going to talk about the salt bridges. There we go. So now you can sort of see this one weak connection between rings. And if I lower the isosurface threshold a little bit more, this connection becomes stronger, and we see this other even weaker connection back there. But that's really all of the connectivity that we see between rings. If we go ahead and put our C alpha trace in that structure and look at which residues are likely to be involved in that connection, we get exactly the residues which are believed to be which are known from the crystal structure to be involved in the salt bridge. The interesting point here, though, is that okay. So here's one more animation. So I'm going to go ahead and rock this a little bit. So since this is a HOMO 14 mer. Any connection that goes from one ring to the other should also be symmetric and go the other way as well. So what I'm showing you here is a line through one of the putative salt bridges and a line through the paired salt bridge here. And then what we see in these balls over here is the positions of some residues which Helen Sable had earlier predicted would be responsible for this weak density right here. And what you see is that there's very strong density for one of the salt bridges, but the other bridge basically is going through space. The salt bridges are asymmetric. Now, this asymmetry had been observed in GROES and nucleotide-bound states of GROEL in the crystal structure. So if you have GROES and nucleotide present in the crystal structure, you also can see an asymmetry in the salt bridges. But it had never been observed before in a GROES-free state. So what this has allowed us to do, even if this particular structure isn't directly on the biological pathway, but what this allows us to do is it allows us to separate out which motions are caused by GROES binding and which motions are caused by nucleotide binding. All of the previous, there aren't any crystal structures of this asymmetric form. The only crystal structures that had nucleotide present in the absence of GROES used non-hydrolyzable ATP, which caused 14-fold binding, which was a completely non-biological process. And then you get a symmetric structure again. So this is the first asymmetric structure. And as to this, the salt bridge that was predicted over here just absolutely cannot exist. And the original interpretation of the crystallographers, who also saw a weak density there, was it's actually a main chain, side chain connection. It just happens to be a side chain that's pointing up across the ring. And it's in exactly the right place for that as well. So that's further demonstration that the structure is probably correct.
Steve,
yeah. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. It's one of them is reasonable and the other one isn't. I have it in another slide somewhere, but too many details. So final results: we've got about four angstrom resolution, single particle based C alpha trace. We got an asymmetric structure out of solution. And that one ring is very much like the APO crystal structure, but the other ring is more similar to a nucleotide bind state, and this has sort of allowed us to separate things out. Now, I have one more point to make. I can go back to this again. I have one more little point to make, just as sort of aside. There's this notion still running around in the community that if I want to look at the resolution of my reconstruction, all I have to do is take a crystal structure and blur it out to whatever level I think my resolution is, and then sort of compare the two, and that'll give me a way of judging my resolution. I want to sort of get rid of that notion as much as I possibly can. So this Groyel is a nice case because we have structures at a bunch of different resolutions. So we have an 11.5 angstrom resolution structure of Groyel, a 6 angstrom resolution reconstruction of Groyel, and now a 4 angstrom resolution reconstruction of Groyel. Now here's the 11.5 angstrom resolution reconstruction, and this is what you get if you take the 4 angstrom resolution reconstruction and blur it to 11.5 angstrom resolution. You can see that in this structure, you can't resolve the separation between the alpha helices. You can't resolve there's still a lot of stuff which remains ambiguous. In this structure, the alpha helices are suddenly standing out. The structure is much, much better. And that's typically what you're going to see in the case of doing this with a crystal structure as well. The point is that when you say I have 4 angstrom resolution, it's not a statement of how blurry your model is. It's a statement of at what level noise begins to dominate over signal in your reconstruction. Okay? It's a measure of the noise in your model. When you just take a crystal structure and blur it by a certain amount, all you're doing is blurring it. You're not putting any noise into it. Okay, so you can't make a crystal structure look like a single particle reconstruction at low resolution just by blurring. Okay, you can do some other things. You know, if you do some rotational blurring as well, and you add a bunch of noise, then maybe you can manage to come up with something. But it's very difficult to simulate that kind of thing. I agree. That's what I'm saying. All right. Your reason for you have an additional reason.
Right.
Yes. Yes. So there are a lot of reasons why you can't do that. Okay. Now the last topic I want to cover is heterogeneity and dynamics. Okay. So I'd say there are sort of two frontiers in cryo-EM. You've got trying to get to higher resolution, and you've got trying to settle this issue of how do you deal with particles that aren't self-consistent in solution. All right, so I'm going to show you another sort of old experiment. This is from like 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm just going to show you part of this experiment. So in this case, we were using SR398, which is a single-ring mutant of Groyel. In other words, it's a homo heptamer in association with Groyes in solution. So in solution, we should see single rings floating around. We have the presence of nucleotide is also present in the system, so we have ATP in here as well. So what we should see in our experiment is we should see single rings floating around, we should see single rings bound to Groyes floating around, and we'll probably also see some Groyes floating around by itself, although we can eliminate this by not boxing it. Here's an example micrograph. I'm going over this example fairly quickly because the point isn't really the biology in this case. The point is the methodology. So if we look at a typical micrograph, we can see these monomers. We can see the single ring floating around free in solution without the cap. This is a side view with the cap. You can see the sort of the triangle shape. We can see all sorts of different shapes in solution here. We can see some top views which have almost the sevenfold symmetry, that sort of thing. Okay, how do we analyze this? Okay, let's start out with some 2D analysis. Okay, so this is the 2D analog of the 3D reconstruction procedure that I was showing you before. This is a procedure that basically the procedure that's used in Imagic when you're doing making your class averages. Although this is a little bit more automated, people do the same sort of concept in Spider as well. The basic idea is you start out instead of with a 3D structure, you start out with some sort of guess at initial 2D class averages. I should say that this isn't this bootstrapping part is sort of out of the sequence of things. Dealing with a bootstrapping problem is sort of separate from what I'm showing here. So we're starting out with some sort of initial guess at what 2D class averages will look like. We start out with a bunch of particle images. Then we actually we'll go through this step by step here. So we start out with particles. This generates our initial set of 2D class averages. Then we have to align the particles to the class averages. So in the 3D reconstruction, we're aligning the particles to the projections. In this case, we don't have projections; we just have 2D class averages. So they don't have to be self-consistent in the sense that they form a 3D reconstruction in any way. So, so in other words, we align each particle to whichever class average it looks the most like, and we end up with sort of our set of aligned particles. Then we run multivariate statistical analysis, also known as single variate decomposition, principal component analysis in various contexts. And we get a set of eigenimages. Did someone talk about multivariate statistical analysis at all so far? I wasn't here the first day. No. Well, I can't explain it to you right now, so that'll have to be a separate topic. So this allows us to do noise reduction, as Powell sort of mentioned in his classification talk yesterday. This allows us to basically do sort of a noise reduction on the particles, and we use that as a basis for better classifying the particles. So in this case, I'm using k-means classification in the subspace defined by these images. And that allows us to do a better classification. Then we take these new class averages, and we wrap them back around, and we iterate the process. And after another iteration, you can see gradually the class averages get better and better. And at the very end, you can see we end up with this very nice set. We end up with some nice top views here. We end up with some nice side views associated with with SR398 associated with GROWES. Some nice side views of the particles without GROWES, and some nice tilted views. And I'm just showing you a subset of the results here, of course. So this is a nice strategy for doing 2D analysis of your particle without imposing any sort of bias which would be caused by the 3D reconstruction process. So here are the results, some of the results from that process. Looks like everything is terrific, right? No problems. There's two states just like we expected, right? Well, not entirely. The problem is I'm not showing you all the results. So here's a set of nice-looking side views. We also saw some that look like this. You can see they look sort of like they're blown up like a balloon. So there's actually some additional heterogeneity going on in the system. The GROWEL the SR398 seems to be undergoing some sort of a little bit of a breathing motion or something like that. So how do we deal with this problem beyond 2D? Well, here's the 3D version of the heterogeneous particle reconstruction routine. This looks exactly like the reconstruction strategy I showed you before, except now instead of starting out with one three-dimensional model, we're starting out with n three-dimensional models, and we're generating n sets of projections. And when we classify the particles, we're not just classifying what orientation they're in, we're also classifying which of the three models they're associated with. So every particle is still only going to be associated with one orientation, but it's also only going to be associated with one of the structures. So then we get a set of three sets of class averages and make n class averages and n sets of 3D models and make n new sets of projections, and we iterate this process. Now, typically, this process is then followed up with an additional non-heterogeneous particle refinement. So in other words, what I'll typically do then is after I've got my three final reconstructions out, I know which particles went into each of these reconstructions, and I pull out those particle sets, and then I re-refine each of those particle sets independently to make sure that we get something self-consistent and that there wasn't any bias caused by this procedure. And this is, again, a fairly straightforward method, fairly well-known in the field. Some of the details vary, but it's in general pretty simple. So when we applied that procedure here with three different starting models, what we found was a nice side view of SR398. the nice capped view of SR398, and then this bizarre state where SR398 is kind of blown up like a balloon. And if we look, just to make sure everything's okay, if we look at this state, we can compare that state to this crystal structure, and it's very nice. It's exactly right. This little lump that you see here in the middle, there's 23 residues missing from the C-terminus in the Groyel reconstructions, and it's well known, it's actually been used in some very clever experiments, that those residues are disordered, and if you form a full Groyel molecule, they push up on the inside, but when you form one of these single ring molecules, they push out the bottom instead. So that's what this little lump sticking out the bottom is. Okay. Next step of the analysis. So that's all I'm going to say about that SR398 system. There's a lot more to it and some biological results there as well, which I'm going to skip for today. So I'm just going to show you some quick results for fatty acid synthase. I won't tell you too much about this molecule. You can read it in the notes if you'd like to know. This is a mammalian form of fatty acid synthase. It's a homodimer. And the most important thing is that it has 7 enzymatic activities. 50 reactions are required to build palmitate molecules, and the palmitate molecules that are being built are then, you know, quite long. They're like, you know, 25, 30 angstroms long. So you have to have this molecule visiting all of these different enzymatic activities. So it's obviously a very dynamic molecule. So what I'm going to do is apply that 2D analysis I showed you before to particles from the system. And you can see various orientations of the particle, but you can also see some sort of interesting sort of heterogeneity here where you can see, so in this particular view, you can see sort of varying separations between these lobes in the structure. Excuse me. So just to help orient you in the structure, it's believed that this is one monomer and this is another monomer, although there's another theory that says that this is one monomer and this, you know, it could be X-shaped or it could be sort of C-shaped. But regardless of that dispute, this isn't a monomer and this isn't a monomer. It's more like this and this. So we can see that there's a lot of dynamics in the structure. Not only do we have different orientations, so we're sort of looking at the end-on view here, we're also seeing a lot of dynamics. So what we can do is we can do a standard single particle reconstruction on this and just sort of mix all of these dynamic states together into one model, and then we can pull out all of the particles that are in one particular orientation. Okay? And hopefully we'll get a large enough subset. This was actually done from a set of 100,000 particle images. So we actually still have a reasonable number of particles in any given orientation. So we'll pull out all the particles that are in sort of this orientation, and then we'll run a different analysis, run the same 2D refinement process on those particles to subdivide those into multiple classes. So in 2D, this gives us a view of the dynamics of the particle. And you can see, if you watch this, this is actually a pretty long animation. There's about, I don't know, 150 frames or something in this. You can actually see these lobes, you know, moving quite substantially. It's about a 25 angstrom motion that we're observing here. And you can also see some of these other little finer motions that are going on in the lobes of this structure. So the problem is this is actually a very complicated sort of motion that we're observing here. And some of the motions are independent from the other motions. While certainly there's some sort of sequencing involved, I should also point out that the sequence that we're looking at here is not true dynamics. This is a pseudo-time sequence. In other words, we created a bunch of these class averages from the particle set, and then we ordered them based on how similar they were to each other. Okay, so this isn't real time. Don't think that we're looking at an actual time sequence or something like that. No, we can't do time-resolved cryo-EM. But nonetheless, this gives you a good feel for the various dynamic states of the particle. So this is very nice, but one thing we'd like to be able to do in, say, this molecule is isolate one portion of the molecule and do this sort of dynamics analysis just on that portion of it so we can see what sort of some of the local independent dynamics might be within the structure. Okay, so let me show you the same analysis now, say, applied to Groyel. Now, you can use the background noise levels to sort of judge how much of what you're seeing is noise and how much of what you're seeing is real. And in the case of Groyel, there's clearly a little bit of dynamics going on here in sort of the apical domain. You can sort of see it here up in the apical domain as well. And you can also notice sort of the salt bridges seem to sort of pop in and out a little bit here. But other than that, there's not a whole lot going on here. Now, let me show you another chaperonin. This is called MMCPN. This is an archaeal chaperonin. It's a type 2 chaperonin. What that means is it doesn't have a co-chaperonin cap that comes in. It's just one self-contained molecule that operates by itself. So this is the open state of a type 2 chaperonin. And we can see that in this state, it's really moving around a lot. You can see the noise levels here is fairly low because we had a lot of particles in this orientation to deal with. And you can see these lobes are sort of bouncing around a lot. And you can actually see it a little bit here in the side view also where we didn't have quite as many particles, so it's a little noisier. but it's moving around quite a lot. What we'd like to be able to do is this motion is too complicated to use that three-dimensional refinement procedure I showed you before on. Okay, there's too many simultaneous motions going on for me to really resolve what's going on here. And the motions are too independent from each other. So what I'd really like to be able to do is sort of chop out a portion of the structure and just do dynamics on that portion of the structure. Well, how would we do that? We're dealing with projection images, right? So this was the sort of off-the-wall idea. Well, maybe we can subtract away what we don't want in the individual particle images and just leave behind some residual density that we could then do some reconstructions on. This was considered sort of a three sigma idea. This was proposed as part of the NIH's roadmap initiative. We were supposed to come up with off-the-wall ideas for doing things that hadn't been tried before. So this was the off-the-wall idea. So this is actually a single particle image of Groyel, a fairly typical one. This is a side view. You may be able to make out sort of the layers in the structure. So this is the orientation of that particle. Now maybe you can sort of see it a little bit better. You'll see it better in a second. Okay? So what I want to do first is demonstrate that I can subtract this particle out and leave behind just the noise, basically. Or I want to mostly subtract it out anyway. So first I have to make the particle, the projection, look like the particle. So I apply the CTF and do some other tricky stuff and make it look like the particle. And now here's my particle image, and here's after I subtract it away. So you can see that we're doing a pretty good job of subtracting it out, right? See the particle vanishing, everyone? Okay, good. All right, so the particle's vanishing. Good. Now what I want to do is I want to use this as a tool for extracting out just one monomer of the molecule. So here's my projection again, and here's my projection without one monomer. So I've just masked out one monomer from the projection. And now I'm going to subtract this. You see the monomer? Yeah, okay. I was pretty skeptical too. Now you say, okay, so that monomer now is about 60 kD, right? 57 kD, right? So it's fairly small. Now you say, well, you know, cryo-EM doesn't really usually work with stuff that small. I mean, we're doing some stuff now with RNA, DNA nucleotide, which has higher contrast at low densities. But if you try to do protein at 50 or 60 kD, that's pretty tricky, right? So it turns out, though, that, I mean, one of the biggest problems in doing small density proteins is that you just can't find them in the images. In this case, I know exactly where it is. I can put it in the middle and I can mask it out, right? Okay, so we'll go ahead and do that. Just for the sake of argument, let's try it and see what happens, right? Okay, so now what I have is I have 14 monomers masked out of every Groyel particle. So I had 20,000 Groyel particles, so I now have 20,000 times 14 monomer images, which have been masked out and roughly centered. Okay, what am I going to do with that? Now, I should point out that the mask is not very tightly following the outline of the particle. The mask has been expanded a little bit, even though it's fairly sharp. Okay, so I did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation. I actually had a larger data set that I worked with here. So I had 560,000 monomers, and the box size was 128 by 128 for the monomers, that after I sort of shrunk it down a little bit. And that would take about 250,000 CPU hours just to try doing one refinement on it. I decided it probably wasn't worth that much investment for a first try. So we shrunk it down. I shrunk it down by a factor of 2, and I only used the first 100,000 particles, so it would run a little bit faster. And I said, all right, well, let's not try and get too ambitious here. So I started out with something that was vaguely Groyel-shaped as a starting model. I didn't try and do this from random blobs in space. So I started out with something vaguely Groyel-shaped, and I just said, all right, let's see what happens, and I refined it. And we got a monomer back out. And in fact, it was a monomer where you could make out the alpha helices. So we managed to pull out the secondary structure from this. So I was impressed. I didn't expect it to work that well. So what's the next step? So the next step is to try and take a look at dynamics. And I think I'm just exactly on time. So I'm just going to show you very quickly some results that literally just finished running a couple of days ago for MMCPN. So what I did with MMCPN is rather than just boxing out a monomer from each particle, I boxed out a dimer. So I boxed out pairs of monomers so we could maybe see if there was any sort of dynamics that was going on between neighboring pairs of monomers, or at least see if I could reconstruct them at all. So really quickly, I will hopefully... How nice. Oh, okay, good. It's not as dead as it appears. All right. Okay, so this is the overall MMCPN molecule. This is about what it looks like. It's very dynamic, so it doesn't resolve much better than that, even if you have a large number of particles to put into it. You can see it's a HOMO 16 mer rather than it's not 14, it's got 16 monomers in it. And you can see at least where the monomers are, even if you can't see many details in this open state. So now I'll show you the results, some of the results anyway, from... So I took this one step further. I didn't just refine a single model. I tried using that multi-reference refinement technique. So first I did a single model, and I got out two things that looked like monomers again, and I said, okay, it's working. So then I actually went ahead and I ran the multi-reference refinement on the the dimer images that were extracted. And I got out some interesting sorts of variations. So some of the particles... So you can see that here's the dimer here. Some of the particles have this little thing stretching up here like this. And other particles, all right, that one also has something sort of stretching up. Other particles look like this. They're much more compact down here. And I don't have the thresholds carefully adjusted here. But you can get the idea here that that there really is a dangly bit that's sort of floating around in solution in this state. And as I say, these are very, very preliminary results. But that gives you sort of an indication of the direction we're moving now in sort of the study of dynamics. And that's basically it. So I want to thank our collaborators. David Chuang has been our longtime collaborator on the GROW-EL work since 2001. Very good collaborator. He gives us specimen whenever we need it, and helps us work out some of the biology. And good guy. Matt Baker did all of the chain tracing work. Donghua Chen collected all of the data. Julie did all of the purification work. And on the MMCPN project, this is a collaboration with Judith Friedman at Stanford, and it's part of the Roadmap Initiative. And George and our group did all the preliminary reconstructions in particle boxing. And Donghua Chen was also involved in some of that. And that's about it. Thanks. So I'm sorry if I actually took all of the time.
I suggest there'll be a lot of questions in our meeting. So why don't we have 10 minutes of questions and things like that, and then make sure we get in a 15-minute break. How does that sound?
Want to amplify my voice right now? I was just wondering. You showed these movies where the looking at molecules in a particular orientation subgroup.
Yeah.
And you impose some kind of similarity order. On what basis did you do the similarity order?
So there's nothing imposed on that at all. That's really just using that straight multivariate classification from scratch. Once you've extracted the subset of particles, you just use the multivariate statistical analysis-based classification iteratively until you get different results.
Right, but then you have an entire set of images.
Right.
Right. And they are not just random now, because you see rather low frequency changes of these domains. Otherwise,
yeah,
the molecules would fly all over the place.
Right.
So you must have imposed some similarity order there.
I'm not sure what you mean by imposing a similarity order.
When you made the movie,
yeah,
what did you do to...
Well, that's what I said. I sorted the images in order of how similar they were to each other. That's what you're asking. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, I see. So what do you want to know? I mean, yes, they're sorted. They're sorted in order of how similar they are to each other. I just used the same sort of similarity criteria I use in particle classification.
Similar.
The same way I define similar in the reconstruction.
Mathematically for us, please.
You apply a Wiener filter.
No.
Okay. It's an algorithm, not an equation.
Okay, so you use that similarity definition.
Probably, although I would have to go back to the code to check to make sure that was the one I used when I did it.
Okay.
because there are a bunch of different similarity criteria that could have been used. For when the particles aren't noisy like this, frankly, it doesn't matter too much which one you use. I mean, the dynamics that are involved are multi-branching, so putting it into a single linear sequence like this is kind of an arbitrary process anyway. I mean, you're gonna sort of follow one branch, and then when you hit the end of that branch, it'll jump back to another point and follow another branch, and then jump back and follow another branch.
Yeah, I agree.
It's really just a visualization tool. Rather than just seeing the jiggling, yeah.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. So, yeah.
Hey, Jay?
Yes. Steve, in the Anand-Sitian case for the image subtraction, how do you normalize or equalize the intensity from the between the raw image and your model projection?
You remember the slide where I said a lot of math at the top? The quick description of the idea is it's basically the same procedure that's used in that complicated similarity procedure, similarity criterion I showed you before. The idea is you try and make the projection look as much like the particle as possible, and the way you do that is by effectively, you know you've characterized the signal-to-noise ratio of the particle, so you know the power spectrum that you're trying to achieve, and you filter the particle to make it look like that. You don't add any noise to it or anything like that, obviously. Obviously, you want to, that's what you're trying to avoid. So basically, you filter the particle to make it look like what you think the filtered particle, filtered by the microscope particle, is. It really takes some math that I can show you. Yeah.
Yeah, so I have to say, I thought you explained what you did quite well, actually. Well, so I
thank
followed
you.
It quite well. But I did have an extra question.
Okay,
is,
good.
In your GROEL, the 4 angstrom, 20,000 particles.
Yeah.
Obviously, you go through the procedure, you put the particles in, you get the map, and the map has a lot of nice features in it. But I wondered, as you progress through it and looked at all the other indicators and statistics and so on, whether you personally have a view as to how many of the 20,000 particles are oriented correctly within, say, a degree, within 5 degrees, and how many are just randomly wrong. And don't...
No, I actually have histograms that allow you, you can make a histogram which allows you to trace the path of particles as they progress through the reconstruction. And what I typically find is about, for this data set, which is well characterized and already been sort of pruned down to the best sets of particles, I would say about 90 to 95% are self-consistent to within a degree. And then the other 5% bounce around a little bit. But that eliminating that 5% that bounces around a little bit doesn't serve any purpose, because if you do that, a different 5% will then bounce around after that. So I tried to use this process where you sort of sequentially find all the particles that are bad, and bad or that aren't being self-consistently assigned, throw them out, refine some more, throw those out, refine some more, throw those out, and you just sort of gradually decrease your population pool, which makes the model noisier, makes more and more particles which don't align properly, and it's a no-win situation. It never improved anything when I tried doing that. But I would say there's about 5% which aren't right.
And of the 95% that, have about a degree or so,
yeah.
That's the self-consistency degree. What do you think the actual, angular? Don't know.
I don't know. I don't have a good way of estimating it. Yeah, so that was actually, I left out a lot of details in that because it was so quick. So that's actually a modified version of fatty acid synthase. It's missing the final enzymatic activity, which cleaves the result out. So this is in theory a fatty acid synthase, which has gone all the way through the cycle, has a palmitate molecule bound to it, and can't release it. But even after, the hope was that if we did that, we'd sort of lock it down a little bit so it wouldn't move around so much. But you can see how well it worked.
Just a follow-up. Is there any hope to moving to a good 3D structure with
the molecules? I have a few 3D structures that were generated by using the multi-model refinement technique on that, and they're a little bit better than what you get if you put it all together into one structure, but there are so many different states, and since, so there were 5-angstrom crystal structure came out, last year, and it's not great because they can only identify about 60% of the mass in the protein. I mean, they can't do a chain trace at all. They sort of identify domains, and there's a bunch of the mass missing and stuff. It's not great, but that answered a lot of the questions that people sort of had. So we're just sort of writing up what we can right now on the sort of dynamics analysis and that sort of thing. I don't know how hard we're going to try to get 10 million particles to, you know, do the dynamics fully.
You gave a list of different measures of similarity, like correlation coefficient and variance and so. Sure. Would you rank them in any case? Or
I like the one I use the best.
Yes.
I would say that within the context of EMAN, and probably it wouldn't be exactly the same in other packages because details matter and they vary. Within the context of EMAN, the thing that I described works the best by a small margin. Various Fourier shell correlation based or roughly equivalently phase residual based methods work the next best, and then methods, sort of naive methods that just use unmodified correlation coefficients and stuff are the worst. Mutual information we've played with, but never really gotten to work very well in this context.